Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this, the second episode of a two-part special featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Chernow, he talks about his latest book, Mark Twain, published in May 2025. Chernow has chronicled the lives of such influential men as Alexander Hamilton, Presidents George Washington and Ulysses S. Grant, and Titan John D. Rockefeller. Ron Chernow was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member John, better known as Jack Farrell.
Now, in Hamilton, there was not the vast body of work to confront of predecessors that you did when you chose Washington. So how do you tackle someone like Washington? You must have had like 1,000 people come up to you and say, what are you working on now? Well, I'm working on Washington. And they said, well, what is there new to say about Washington or why? So how did you make that choice? And it's part of that is, do you have people, either friends and family or agents and editors, who steer you, or is this all just a process of walking the streets?
Pretty much me. The only idea that was ever suggested to me was John D. Rockefeller, and I turned that down at first, but then as I began to explore it, I realized that it was an excellent idea. I've been very lucky with my choice of subjects. The people that I've written about, almost all of them, were very well-known personalities, which meant that there had been a lot of previous books. So why would I dare to add to the pile of books? In almost every case, there was a significant addition, new addition of papers that had suddenly made available thousands, tens of thousands of new documents. So with George Washington, at the time that I was working on the Washington book, the George Washington Papers Project had already published 60 of a projected 90 plus volumes. And in the case of Mark Twain, the Mark Twain Papers Project out at Berkeley has been in operation for 50 years. And so they have 12,000 letters written by Mark Twain and his immediate family, 17,000 letters written to them, et cetera. It's voluminous. And so I feel that if you have the time to sit and read, and I'm lucky that I do have that time, an inclination, I knew that I could go a lot deeper with all of these people. And it was not a knock on earlier biographers who really did not have the advantage of all of these post-World War II papers projects. In the case of Ulysses S. Grant, it was 32 volumes. At the time I wrote it, I think they had just published the 32nd and final volume. There were 50,000 documents in those 32 volumes. Then down at the Grant Presidential Library, there were an additional 200,000 documents. So I've been lucky. I've kind of been standing on the shoulders of all of these scholars, you know, who labor in obscurity to amass this material. And I felt, Jack, at times that the one drawback of having this much material available is that people are become more reluctant to do the whole life, because mm-hmm. they sort of look at the massive amount of material. Certainly when you get into your era, the presidential libraries.
Yeah, certainly with Nixon and his tapes, I could have listened for years.
Yeah, so you get into kind of modern presidential libraries, you're suddenly talking about millions of documents. And so I think that as we have all these wonderful presidential libraries, as well we have these papers projects, I sometimes worry that people will sort of look at that and say, oh, you mean, if I want to do a biography of Washington or Grant, I have to read all of that. And so the temptation then is to do the period of the life, theme of the life, something like that, to try to make it more manageable. And that may be where I have the advantage in writing these books. I'm doing nothing but writing these books. You know, so I've never had, sorry, when I was a freelance magazine writer in my 20s, but I've never had a day job, so I can wake up every morning, just work exclusively on this project. And given the massive amount of material that I've had to go through with all of the books, I couldn't imagine doing it if I was a journalist or even a college professor.
Well, I think it was Twain who said that biography is impossible because there's just so many instant flashes of thoughts and desires and passions that go through a person's mind. And yet, with Mark Twain, I think that you came closer in this book, albeit it took 1,000 pages to do it, but you came closer in this book, I think, to capturing the internal life of a human being. You had a tremendous amount of material to work with, but it's a transforming book because I think everybody's version of Mark Twain is still Hal Holbrook in the white suit being funny on stage. And you portray a man that a great comic, a great celebrity who for much of his life was in agony.
Thank you for that description. The book, which I like to think is accurate, Mark Twain. The Mark Twain line was that biographies are but the clothes and buttons of the man. The biography of the man himself cannot be written. And so I was very, very lucky to have this endless, endless material about him. And he's such a complicated character. You kind of peel off one layer and another layer and another layer, and you never finally feel that you kind of get to the bottom of it. There's so many different kind of sides. He was such a vast mind and a complicated mind, but it's a tragic story. What I noticed, biographers divide into two groups. There are those biographers who will read previous biographies and the others who will dive straight into the historical materials. I remember Edmund Morris would not read the other biographies. My friend Stacy Schiff will not read the other biographies. My approach has always been different. I want to see how that person has been portrayed in the past, and there's often a kind of historical consensus. And then I want to go into the original historical documents. And I always find that there's a discrepancy between the character that I've met in the other biographies and the character that I'm meeting is firsthand in the original materials. And in that gap is for me the sweet spot. That gap is going to be the book. And what I found with Mark Twain, I mean, such the power of his personality and such the power of Hal Holbrook, very often there would be almost kind of jocular tone to, some of the books written about him that we kind of have to get funny. But the life, Mark Twain had a tragic view of life. I mean, he once said that life is a tragedy with some comedy distributed here and there, but only to heighten the sense of pain, really kind of. And another point, he said life was, sweetness embittered by sorrow, pleasure poisoned by pain. He really had a very kind of dark view of life. And this is someone who, he buried his beloved younger brother Henry, then his 18-month-old son Langdon, buries his beloved wife Livy, buries two of his three daughters. At one point in the book, I said the basic thing is that he never attempted suicide. It just becomes darker and darker and darker. And so I really feel nothing delighted me more than to write that kind of jocular book about Mark Twain and just Mark and Tom and Huck and life on the Mississippi and just, stop there.
Oh, let me just interject very quickly to aspiring readers. Chernow does not shortchange us on the wit of Mark Twain because it's a delightful sweet and sourness in that as you're going along reading one of these things, you pick from one of the letters one of his great hysterical witticisms, lines, most of which we haven't heard of, which make you laugh out loud even as you're about to turn the page into a one more description of great sorrow.
I'm so glad you said that, because most people know two or three of Mark Twain's books. He published 2 dozen books. He published probably at least 1,000, 2,000 magazine articles. So I was painfully aware as I was reading through, because I talk about all 2 dozen of the books. Most people don't know that he wrote a book about Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science. They
Joan
don't
of
know,
Arc.
which he thought was his best book, his novel about Joan of Arc. He wrote a book about Shakespeare, claiming that Francis Bacon had really written all of the Shakespeare plays. So I kind of talk about all of the books. And one of the things that I tried to do, since I know that at least 3/4 of his books are never going to be read again by anyone, I would try in each case to take out some irresistibly funny or witty or delightful passage, because I would look at it and I would be laughing at my desk and I'd say, you know what? If you put it in, these lines are going to become part of Mark Twain lore. If you just skip over it and don't, it's lost forever. No one is, it's like you're kind of wandering through the woods. You say, no one is ever going to take this path again. And if I discover something, I want to put it. So one of the reviews I like, and it said that it was actually a treasury of Mark Twain sayings, which pleased me greatly because I was hoping I would always sort of picture a couple sitting up in bed, you know, at night, you know, and the husband saying, honey, I have to read this. And the people kind of sharing and just the delight. He was just so unbelievably funny. And I have to say, I got first interested in Mark Twain, maybe more the platform artist than the novelist, because when I was 25 and living in Philadelphia, I went to see Hal Holbrook. And there he was, 90-minute one-man show. He was there with the white suit and the cigar and the mustache. And a lot of it was the political witticisms, really kind of played to my strong suit. In fact, years later, when I spoke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I used a number of the lines that I heard from Holbrooke. You know, there's no distinctly Native American criminal class except the Congress, or, you know, suppose you're an idiot and suppose you're a congressman, but I repeat myself, you know, and
Exactly.
all of these, I go on and on. I was just howling with laughter that, you know, humor tends to date very quickly. So we might be laughing hysterically at Saturday Night Live. 5 years later, no one would even understand the references anymore. And, you know, I'm sitting there that night with Hal Holbrook and thinking, it's kind of incredible that these lines were written of what, you know, 100 years before, and they're still fresh and funny. And in fact, you know, late in Mark Twain's life, someone gave him an anthology of American humor, and there were about 40 or 50 humorists who were anthologized in this book. And he started looking through it, and he had known all of these people, but he realized that he was the only one who was still around and not forgotten, that all these other
Yeah.
people had just faded into obscurity. And it was because their humor depended on topicality, whereas he was able to come up with humor that did not depend on a particular set of passing circumstances. I did an interview with Conan O'Brien, which is great to be able to be interviewed about Mark Twain by a professional comedian. And Conan pointed out that Mark Twain's like the original one-liner artist. You know, that Mark Twain understood, as I probably don't, the importance of succinctness, you know, in writing. And that if you come up with like the perfectly phrased one-liner, that goes kind of straight into our, you know, mind and our heart and gets us to laugh.
Yeah. The only person I can think of to compare it to is Groucho.
Yeah, and I think that I often thought of Groucho as working on Mark Twain because it was like their mind was wired to produce these one-liners.
Yeah.
And it was just effortless. Twain could turn it off, but when he wanted to turn it on, whether it was at a dinner party on a lecture stage, he had no trouble whatsoever.
And not that the other people that you wrote about did not have tumultuous lives and tumultuous personal lives, but this one is particularly a life marked by grief and tragedy and success. Could you have written this book when you were 35?
No, actually, one of the reasons I wanted to write it's a very, very good question. One of the reasons that I wanted to write this book is that, you know, I lost my beloved wife in 2006. And I remember seeing Ken Burns did a 4 hour Mark Twain documentary back in the 1990s. The first 2 hours were kind of familiar. This was Hal Holbrook, you know, Mark Twain. It was Tom and Huck and Life on the Mississippi. The second half was about the business blunders, the bankruptcy, the 9 years of exile in Europe, the around the world tour to pay off his debt, but also all of the deaths, particularly the death of this adored wife. And I could remember thinking to myself, I think being aware that it's one of those experiences in life that you can't describe the experience to someone else. You have to have lived through it. And so I could feel his emptiness after Livy dies. And also, it reminded me in certain ways of my own marriage, because Livy made Mark Twain presentable in polite society. For all his brilliance, he was a bit of a rough, as he said, I was a mighty rough, coarse, unpromising subject when he met Livy. And Livy kind of made him a little more socially acceptable. He didn't quite know how to do a dinner party without saying something that was so sharp and brusque that people, would not be affected by it. But this very interesting moment after Libby dies, two of the daughters were still alive, and he suddenly has to plan. He suddenly has to be a father in a way that he hadn't been before. And he said to the daughters, or he said in one of the letters, he said, "I don't know how to plan. Libby always did all of the planning." He not only feels bereft emotionally, he just feels completely unhinged as a widower. And then what happens is that, because you've been married all these years, and then suddenly there are certain impulses that have not been expressed in your life. And a lot of them really quite strange. What happens in those final 6 years, he had always had, as I try to reconstruct, he always had a fascination with teenage girls. He actually started three clubs in his life. One, while Libby was still alive, the Saturday Morning Club back in Hartford. He was the only male member. The rest were young women. Then, when Libby is dying, he starts the Juggernaut Club. He's corresponding with these women in foreign countries. He's again the only male member of this all-female club. And then, most infamously, the Aquarium Club, with the angelfish. That's after Libby dies. This was obviously a tendency that was there that had been suppressed while she was alive. And so different sides to his personality are expressed. And would I rather not have written about that? Yeah, I didn't enjoy writing about that, particularly since I knew that dealing with the angelfish would be towards the end of the life and hence would have a greater impact. I tend to find it more fun to, write the admiring stuff than the damning stuff. But I have my
Well, that's
policy.
it. I think you did it with it. I did not come away with it thinking, boy, this guy's, weird and hideous. I came away with, at least some empathy for, like Jefferson with Sally Hemings. His wife has just passed away. He's looking for some sort of comfort, some sort of reclaiming of those lo of his lost youth, those lost days, and in walks her half sister.
No, well,
So.
that's what you're saying, Jack. I mean, that was exactly the spirit in which I wrote it, trying to sort of give all sides of that. But I've always had a policy with the biographies, particularly if I feel that it's going to end up an admiring biography, to make sure that I have not omitted anything that could suddenly be stated on the other side. So, I mean, for me, my nightmare is someone saying, "Of course, Chernow admired Hamilton. He didn't talk about ABC." I want to make sure that A, B, C, and D are in the book. And I feel that if somebody is a great figure in history, he or she can carry the weight of their own flaws. It doesn't require me to sort of pretty it up. But the Mark Twain book turned out to be on as large a canvas, if I could put it this way, as any of my other books. Here I did Washington was the American Revolution, Constitutional Convention, Creation of Federal Government, Ulysses S. Grant, Mexican War, Civil War, Reconstruction. And then I do Mark Twain. I feel like it's as big and eventful a story as any of those books. I felt I had my hands full, not only with him as personality and just making sense of that, but just his life is so eventful and action-packed. There was just a restless energy. He once wrote to his mother early in his adulthood. He said, "I have to move, exclamation point, move, exclamation point, move." There was a wanderlust. There was a restless quality to his soul. And so it was interesting. I'm sure if you're writing about Henry James or Edith Wharton, that there are quiet, contemplative moments. Twain is that rare case of a writer where so much is happening outside of his writing. And at one point in the book, I say that it was hard to know whether Mark Twain was a writer with business sidelines or a businessman with a writing sideline because he's devoting so much time to trying to become a tycoon
And a celebrity.
and a
Somebody
celebrity. My God.
where he would arrive at the docks and the reporters would line up just waiting for that one line that they could write back and write a story about.
Yeah, and actually going talking about his childhood. He made this story that the one thing that a boy craves is attention. He says, "A boy would be a clown in the circus. A boy would be a pirate on a ship. A boy would sell his soul to the devil, if only to be the object of envy and attention. But that's how he's feeling about boy. He loved when kids would gather around, he would tell a story. That carries right through his entire life. And in fact, I really wanted this book to be a family saga of the Clemens family.
It
So
is.
great materials available about not just Livy, all the correspondence, but all three of the daughters. And of the three daughters, the one daughter who is really wrestling with her father all the time is the middle one, Clara, and she hated being Mark Twain's daughter. She felt that she was reduced to that. But she said that when she and her father went to a reception, she said, "Father fluttered the room with his talk." I love that verb, "Father fluttered the room with his talk." And so, in fact, there was she aspired to be a pianist, and she aspired to be a singer. And when she made her debut as a singer, Mark Twain wanted to come out on stage at the end. And she firmly said no, but he persisted. And finally she said, okay. So he comes out, she leads him out by the hand at the end of the performance. And he quiets down the crowd and he starts to saying, "Well, tonight reminds me of the first time that I did a lecture in San Francisco in 1966. And he talks like for 15 or 20 minutes about this. And so Clara's recital was very widely reviewed, but 90% of the articles was about Twain's debut in San Francisco in 1866. And then at the very end, they would mention Clara. So it was not easy being married to him. It was not easy being one of the daughters. But each of the four women, Livy and the three daughters, each one brought out a different side in his personality. It was quite interesting.
It inspires thoughts of King Lear.
Yes, other people have said that. I confess it did not occur to me as I was writing the book. I was a little bit slow on the draw on that one, but you're absolutely right.
Okay, two fast questions and I'll let you go. And thank you so much for giving us this time. One is, I think I stole this question from Stacy. Do the subjects of your books show up in your dreams?
It's a wonderful question. I can only think of one time John D. Rockefeller showed up in one of my dreams. And I think I know why he was the only one who showed up in my dreams, because you can't in a dream suddenly have someone, in a wig and buckle shoes who appears in your dream. So you can't have people who are going to be wearing the costume of their eras suddenly appearing in your dream. Now, John D. Rockefeller died in 1937. So when you see him in the pinstripe suit in the 1920s or 1930s, he looks contemporary in a way. And I guess he entered into deeply into my mind. I'll tell you a wonderful story, because this was had a big impact on me. When I started doing the Rockefeller book, I was spending 2 or 3 days a week up in Pocantico, the Rockefeller Archive Center. And the family had just made public his papers and the Standard Oil papers. And so I imagined that there was going to be one explosive revelation after another. And there wasn't. John D. Rockefeller, there were tens of thousands of letters that he wrote as head of the biggest business enterprise in the world. All of his letters were 2 or 3 lines long. And a typical John D. Rockefeller letter was, "Dear Sir, read yours of the 25th. Recommend that you proceed with all due caution," signed John D. Rockefeller. He never used proper names. He never specified what he was talking about. And I came back from one of these research trips and I was having dinner with my wife. And I said to her, "This book is going to be a disaster." She said, "Why?" I said, and I described the letters. I said, There's nothing there. There's nothing to latch on to." And I said, "He wrote every letter as if it might someday fall into the hands of a prosecuting attorney or an investigative committee." As I was getting angrier and angrier, her smile was getting wider and wider. And I said, "Why are you smiling? This is a disaster." And she said, "The personality you're describing is so fascinating. You're sort of trying to look behind him. The story is staring you in the face. Imagine a man who has a mind that he can steer the biggest business in the world with all these little winks and nods." And it was kind of a turning point for me, because it made me realize, and John D. Rockefeller was certainly the most secretive person by far that I have written about, but it made me realize that all of us, whether we like it or not, we reveal ourselves. We even reveal ourselves in the way that we try to hide. The truth is revealing. And so I was trying to find, because I had done Morgan, Morgan was a tycoon. He would bang the table and he would roar. And I was kind of looking for that type of personality. John D was silent and crafty, and everything was mysterious and indirect. And actually, it turned out that he was probably the most original business figure in American history because of that. So, luckily, I have to say, the people who were writing to him were not street at all. It was like, as I said before, it might be a 10-page letter how they bribed the Maryland legislature. And he would say, recommend that you proceed with all due caution. So as I started finding the letters that had prompted his letters, I realized that I would be able to fill in all of those blanks as well.
And last question, I don't know if you want to answer it. Have you chosen a new subject?
Yes, art has been a big part of my life. And as I looked at all the books, because Twain was my eighth book. As I looked at all the books that I'd done, I saw kind of my life, my interests reflected in all the books, except in one area. I've collected art for many years. It's been an enormous part of my life, an enormous fascination and obsession. So I decided that I wanted to do an American artist, and I am. And it's James McNeill Whistler, of
Ooh.
Whistler's Mother fame, and great character, and also kind of like Rockefeller, like very, very dramatic life of the sort you would not expect
Was that
in art.
pre-impressionism or impressionism or?
It was pre-impressionism, but actually he knew Degas and Monet because he studied in Paris. He's American, born in Massachusetts, grew up in Connecticut, actually flunked out of West Point. He had so many demerits. He flunked out of West Point, but then he studied in Paris. For 5 years. Then we went to London. Most of his adult life was in London. Part of that time he was in Venice, part of the time he was in Paris. And so he knew all of the Impressionists and they respected him greatly. I was just reading this morning about one of Whistler's paintings, and the critic noted that Degas had taken extensive notes. I was so fascinated by this one painting. So I like the fact that the story is going to be American. Also, when he was a teenager, his father was a civil engineer, and the Tsar of Russia brought him to St. Petersburg to oversee the train from St. Petersburg to Moscow. And so his teenage son spent 6 years studying art. It's a very, very kind of colorful and very, very international life. So I'm excited. There's always, and you've been there, there's always that moment after years of being immersed in a subject that it's time to move on.
Oh, good. Ron, thanks so much.
Well, thank you again for this very, very thoughtful questions. I know how busy you are, that this takes a lot of preparation. So thanks a million again.
That was award-winning author Ron Chernow speaking with fellow biographer and bio member Jack Farrell via Zoom in October of last year. Chernow's latest book, Mark Twain, was published in May 2025 by Penguin Random House. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.